Our second speaker is Daniel Kamen. He's a distinguished professor of energy at the University of California, Berkeley, and he also holds an appointment in the Goldman School of Public Policy. He was coordinating lead author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. He's founding director of the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory and co-director of the Berkeley Institute of the Environment. He's the author of over 200 scientific articles, one book, 30 technical reports. He's widely sought after as a speaker all over the world because of his knowledge of energy and the environment, renewable energy systems, and he also is an expert on the economic impacts, the policy impacts, the health impacts of energy generation and use. He's worked with the National Governors Association on energy policy. He's testified over 30 times before Congress and several state legislatures, including Connecticut, Florida, Minnesota, New York. He advises several organizations, including the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the African Academy of Sciences, the United States and the Swedish Agencies for International Development, and the World Bank. He's married. He has two daughters. And I want you to take a close look at him. Does he look a bit familiar to you? Now, if you're a TV buff, you might have seen him on 60 Minutes or on Nova, or you may have seen him on the Discovery Channel as host of Ecopolis, the City of the Future. And if you're a music buff, you may have seen him doing wiring for the Grateful Dead. So this is a man of many talents. His topic today is jobs in a clean energy economy, science, engineering, and policy perspectives. Join me in welcoming Professor Daniel Kamen.
Well, thank you. I'm not quite sure what to do with that introduction, except to say that a couple of those were a very long time ago, I think is the only comment worth saying there for a couple of them. I think actually the most important point actually is there's a remarkable synergy between my comments and what you just heard from Harry Holzer in terms of the big picture messages. And so actually before I advance the slides, let me just highlight those, because there really is a very simple bottom line, and that is that in terms of thinking about the clean tech, the high-tech energy economy, there's a clear set of successes and some not successes, and the successes are very much fit this model, that states, cities, regions, countries that follow an integrated plan, that invest in research and development, that invest in workforce training at a variety of levels, and also build markets through policies, do significantly better than places that pick one or two of those but not do all three. And that actually couldn't be much simpler. I mean, there's lots of examples, both in the United States and internationally, of places that have taken on doing parts of all of them, and we'll look at those as we go ahead. The other one, which is less obvious to most, except for that energy is now, of course, so squarely in the news, is that the energy economy that we generally regarded for the last several decades as this slow-moving, generally supertanker was the image used, that picture has changed dramatically. And there are now cities, states, countries, provinces that have changed their energy economy dramatically quickly by doing these things. I don't mean a few percent. I mean jumping the amount of different sectors, be it investment in nuclear or hydro or solar or wind or biofuels. There are places that have grown those sectors from less than a percent to 10, 20, or even 30% of the overall economy. So these are really big changes, and we really didn't look at that very carefully up until a very few years ago. That data is now squarely in. So I'll try to illustrate a few of those points as we go ahead. This is actually a graph developed by Professor Greg Nemeth, who's in the back over here. He's at the University of Wisconsin. And this just highlights kind of the basic picture at the federal level. This is a sort of a temporal plot of a number of the big ticket federal funding programs in a variety of areas, from across sectors, from the Manhattan Project to the Apollo effort to the Project of Independence under President Carter to Reagan's defense effort, the war on terrorism, a doubling of the National Institute of Health budget, et cetera. These are all examples of both the size of these programs and their temporal duration. And at the point that Greg developed this, we were actually advocating that because of needs in terms of workforce issues, in terms of energy diversification, that thinking about a 5 to 10-fold increase in funding in these areas at the federal level was prudent to meet everything, again, from jobs issues to energy independence to climate issues. Interestingly enough, it has come in at the high end of this. So if you look at the money in the stimulus program and the monies that are even up through the 2011 budget, I think that we both hoped that we would be at this 10 times increase level, and in fact, that's just about where we are. How this money gets extended out for the years beyond 2011, 2012 is still in question, but in terms of seeing an absolute sea change in the amount of money and programs at the federal level, these are absolutely there. And so we literally are right here. And in fact, in an energy-centric bit of accounting, if you look at the stimulus package, energy received the largest chunk of that. Healthcare and energy are, people argue about some of the programs at the margins, but if you, we're looking at a very, very large overall increase. So it does speak quite clearly to a huge federal push in this area, and in fact, those agencies, not just in the energy area, in education, in health, et cetera, that have accessed this have found some dramatic new amounts of funding available. One more bit of background, just to kind of set the stage. This shows federal investment in research in energy going back to the 70s, and so what you see here is a bump up in investment that President Carter put in, and what we then saw was kind of a long, slow malaise and decline. And the black is the public sector money. Private sector did even worse. It sort of took all the worst cues from the federal decline that happened in the late 80s and 90s until very recently, at which point the private sector money from corporations, both US and domestic, really began to increase dramatically. And in fact, if I have it on the slide properly, there we go. The ramp up in terms of the, this is our Secretary of Energy right here, stuck on the dollar bill. Done with his approval, he's a close personal friend, so I just wanted to, these are chew dollars. But this ramp up is literally what's happened. And so we're seeing the largest change since the Carter run up, and actually in real terms, it's larger right now. So there really is a huge pot of not just money, but of programs to interact with and look at in this area. A detailed picture that I won't go through the numbers are, I put it in the packet so you have it, but just so that we don't sort of, you know, talk about budget numbers but not talk about innovation and what goes on, what this shows in micro detail is more work done by Professor Nemeth, and this shows the correlations that we see between funding in a whole given set of areas, in nuclear, in bioenergy, in fuel cells, in photo, and photovoltaics, and wind, that funding levels and patents, kind of the most basic measure of innovation, track very closely. And so investment in these areas really does lead to new levels of innovation, into all the things that you would expect. So there is a very clear and a direct correlation. I think it's important to put that out there, even if it's in sort of micro-sized graphs, so you've got it in one's notes, just to refer back if needed. This brings me to what I think is the biggest picture point here. And there really is a battle of tipping points going on. We hear all the time about the negatives, both in terms of some environmental change issues and sort of worrying about how the climate's doing. That's a macro issue of which states and countries can participate, but no single one can deal with it. But also the dramatic changes in where investment is going in what is seen by many as the economy of the future. The president, in addressing the Senate Democrats yesterday, highlighted in particular and was asked multiple questions about the investment in China in this area. And I had the pleasure to spend a huge amount of time in China over the last 6 months looking at this area. If you look at the raw numbers, it's really staggering. China, despite being one of the largest consumer of coal in the world, is also the largest investor in solar and wind and batteries for electric vehicles and more efficient gas turbines. It is a dramatic change. There's a climate story in the background about how much the US, China, India, and others are emitting on greenhouse gases. But in terms of investment in these areas, China is doing the features I'm going to describe in the coming bits. Let me just highlight a little bit of that. China is the world's largest investor in building a grid to where they anticipate new sources of energy will come from. In their case, it is largely building out new grid extension to where they see a tremendous amount of wind resources. China is also the largest investor right now in workforce training, not at the research and development side, but in the sales side. China has a national program to train tens of thousands of salespeople in what they see as the clean energy economy of the future. And irrespective of one's position on the climate issues, that is a huge change. And in fact, many of the discussions in Copenhagen boiled down to what was essentially a G2 summit, quite annoying to the Europeans, but a US-China discussion on not only what they would do around climate issues, but more directly where industrial policy would go. And the president has reflected that overall, including yesterday's discussions. So the basic story is that we and a number of other laboratories have been tracking the job creation in the green job sector for quite a few years. This is a 2004 report done at the behest of two senators, and there's an updated version that I wrote just in this past March. In this case, I wrote it actually with Detlef Engel, an interesting character. He is the CEO of the world's largest wind company. It's based in that industrial giant of Denmark. And this company installs a wind turbine somewhere in the world every 5 hours. This is a former bicycle manufacturing company that is now employing 20,000 people in the green job sector. The message has not changed very much since the early part of this decade. The job numbers have been tracked by a number of groups. I am not an economist, so I do the more simple-minded thing. I don't actually build economic models for what's going to be the returns. We do a great deal of surveying of companies around the world in terms of how many jobs are being created in a whole variety of areas. And so like I try to stay as simple-minded as possible. We have students who go out and survey these companies, and some of them go work on them and just literally track the numbers of employees per area. And the message has been very, very simple. I want to give the more quantitative bit of it first, and then I'll back off to the more general part of it. When you look across the energy spectrum at job creation per dollar invested and per megawatt, per output amount of energy, jobs created in the so-called clean tech sector are dramatically higher producers of new jobs than investing in the conventional economy. That's fossil fuel and hydro and other areas. I'm going to come back to explain that in a bit, but I want to just give a feel for the size of that difference. Per dollar invested, you get roughly five times as many jobs for an investment in solar, whether that's solar on one's rooftop or whether those are large arrays of solar that are being installed everywhere from Southern California and Mexico to Germany and to Ontario. Five times more jobs per dollar invested. In the wind area, it's about three times more jobs. Investments in energy efficiency and weatherization, and weatherization has been the largest single winner in the stimulus program and in the 2011 budget, with huge increases in the amount of federal monies available for state and local programs that invest in energy efficiency, improving the efficiency of buildings. That is a huge gain, and that's about three times the number of jobs per dollar invested than a comparable investment in oil or gas-fired new technologies. The numbers vary around a little bit based on where you are, but the basic story is that those numbers have been borne out by study after study, and that's really the most important thing if one is on the quantitative side, looking at the numbers. This is, however, not an argument that renewable energy is somehow better than fossil fuel. This is simply an assessment that if you're building a new industrial area, you get more jobs. You're building infrastructure. And so this is not something special about the clean tech area. It is a feature of growing a sector of the economy. So it should get some credit on the jobs front, but it shouldn't be given any sort of special position. And some groups have argued that, well, this is inherently because these jobs are better. That is not true. That is because you're growing a new part of the economy. That said, the important big picture point, I think, is actually not the details of whether it's 3.2 jobs in one area versus another. It's the much larger macroeconomic picture that if you are not investing in purchasing fuel and you're investing in building companies, training individuals, you are simply putting those dollars into generating new businesses, new training in the workforce, and not simply buying fuels. And if we look at a state budget like Wisconsin, with roughly $16 billion spent to import fossil fuels each year, similar numbers across much of the country, those dollars, if spent to a larger percentage on building workforce development, companies that are in state. That's investing in the so-called knowledge economy, the capital of individuals and companies, as opposed to buying fuels. That is, again, not an argument to say that any given region should go 100% in this direction. That's a very unlikely scenario. But it does speak to a macroeconomic feature, that diversifying in these ways is a critically important part of the story. If I do kind of one of the sort of the nerd graphs, of which I admit I'm quite fond, what this shows is job creation in the states that have done the largest features of this. And so what I'm highlighting here is the following. In states that have not only invested in energy research, training at high school, vocational, college levels, and the last feature, have worked to build market share for clean energy, those are where the largest fraction of these jobs have gone in the past and are forecast to go in the future. And so the numbers I chose here were in line with the current bill that you're discussing here, and that calls in Wisconsin for 25% of the energy mix to come from renewables by 2025. The so-called 25 by 25 plan, that's exactly in line with President Obama's national call. The reason why I highlight this is because this particular policy, the so-called renewable portfolio standard, or requiring a certain fraction of energy to come from renewables, in the United States has been the most effective of the policies implemented. There is a big debate between US states and Europe over whether this policy, the so-called quota for clean energy policy, or the one pursued in Europe and in Ontario and other places, a so-called feed-in tariff, meaning giving fixed long-term guaranteed returns for clean energy. There's a debate as to which one of those strategies is better. 31 of the US states have adopted versions of this renewable portfolio standard, and they have proved highly effective in the states that have done them. They've been a way to help to guarantee that market sector. And again, when I mentioned in the beginning, these three pieces of the story, investing in the research part of the equation, investing in workforce training, and building markets, it really is critical to look at policies or sets of policies that do all three, not to do one or two of the three. You really need to pull them all together. And that should be no surprise, because this is, in many areas, building a new sector, so it does make a large difference. An example and the starting point of this process is energy efficiency. And energy efficiency is, in some sense, the most boring but the most exciting of all these areas. It's the most boring because it is picking at a problem with 10,000 little individual issues. Better lighting, better insulation, tankless water heaters, et cetera, et cetera. All of these things add up to be part of an energy efficiency picture. And for a long time, there were a number of states, Wisconsin among them, that had picked a part of these policies. A classic example of that, this is actually a picture from the Moscone Center in San Francisco. Here's an example of not only saving money, but of actually improving things. This is the side of the exhibition floor that had the old style incandescent lights. This is the side with the new efficient lights. This building saved $400,000 a year in its electricity bill, and demonstrably the quality of lighting is better. So it is not just one should invest because you'll save energy. There's a whole variety of opportunities, again, from the lighting to heating sides, where the quality of the service itself can be better. And that's an important feature. This is not simply replacing a brown electron with a green electron. This is actually getting a better electron, if you will, out of the story. The other part of it is there's a whole range of aggressive policies in place. I've highlighted one from California only because our Public Utilities Commission chair said he would slap me if I didn't highlight his story. And this is one that is now being replicated in a number of states. Florida is working on a version of this. There's an Arizona, a New Mexico version. A number of European states have done the same thing. This is going to sound like an incredibly aggressive target. The California standard is to have all new homes by 2020 net energy generation. That does not necessarily mean solar panels on the roof. It can mean buildings that have bought into a wind farm nearby that are doing programs to use waste heat in the basement. But it critically means making the buildings as efficient as possible first. And in fact, the largest new home sales sector in Germany, the Netherlands, and Portugal are homes that are forecast to be net energy producers. And I highlight this because it really changes the equation in a very interesting way. if one's utility bill in the long term goes from not just a sunk cost, but a potential to earn income on properties that are both residential and commercial. As we are now starting to see, that flips an interesting part of one's fixed expenses. I'm going to skip a little bit of the details in the efficiency story, and I want to highlight, I'm going to jump ahead just so there's a few examples here. I want to highlight what I mentioned about the rapid growth and the rapid change in energy economies and give one important example. This is kind of a nerd's dream. This is the forecast done by the solar energy sector in Europe in the 1990s. I was involved in this commission, one of those lone Americans on the committee. And this was forecasting what the growth of the solar sector would be back in the 90s. This is, of course, done by a whole bunch of solar advocates, so these curves were as aggressive as they thought possible. Local, state, and federal changes in Germany, in California, in New Jersey, in Japan, all found ways to initially subsidize solar. This is what happened. So in other words, the nerds like me were wrong. The sector grew dramatically more rapidly because policies were put in place to help build the markets. And in fact, the growth in solar, the growth in wind have demonstrated this sort of much, much higher rate of growth than we forecast a little while ago. One of the versions of this is that China has become, for many states, for many places, the shop floor for building these technologies. And in fact, number one on the industrial policy discussions right now in Washington is about what do we need to do at the local level so that we will see this same kind of growth in clean energy production. Again, it's not just those five times more jobs you get, it's building that industrial base for export. And a number of U.S. companies have now done some dramatic growth to try to keep pace. They've largely done so with both federal and state support to help build these parts of the clean economy. I'm going to skip one technical story because I want to highlight a piece of the financial part of the story. It does not have to do with the technology pieces. It has to do with innovative financing. One version of this is that states, cities, and countries across the solar installation spectrum, from very solar-intensive places, Mexico, New Mexico, Texas, to Germany, Canada, et cetera, have found that not only is investing in local generation on rooftops a good way to go in terms of job creation, but there are some very clever things to do that were not even on the equation a little while ago. This is an example of one of those. These are buildings where the solar panels are not built over the rooftop, but they actually are the roof. And so if you do so-called building integrated technologies, you find some dramatic ways to save. Right? Roofing is an expensive thing to redo, as anyone who has recently or is planning on re-roofing has found, but there's now a whole range of companies from 3M and Siemens and GE who are now building solar panels, again, tuned in some places for areas that are more sunny or less sunny, that actually are the rooftop themselves. You amortize the cost of the technology into re-roofing. And it's actually made everything from big box stores to individual homes, buildings you can now think of as power plants. And I'm going to conclude with one discussion of a financial mechanism to again highlight where innovations come from and some dramatic changes that are possible out there. So this is a program called PACE Financing, Property Assessed Clean Energy. And we're very pleased that we started it in Berkeley, but it has gone viral. And over 2 years, I'll explain what has happened to it. PACE financing is as simple as the following observation. Actually, the mayor of Berkeley, California's chief of staff was asked to think about some of the energy programs a city could do. And he noticed, not something too surprising, that cities all around the world routinely lend money to property owners so that they can improve sidewalks, improve underground power lines, improve sewer lines. And they do so by borrowing money from the city, typically set up as a bond or as a bank line of credit. They do this, they invest the money, they pay nothing up front themselves, and then they repay the cost of doing this with an extra property tax payment over, for example, 20 years. Why aren't we doing this in the energy area? So the Berkeley chief of staff and I had a discussion, and Berkeley set up such a program. Berkeley, of course, had a good idea, but was unable to implement it very well due to local Berkeley politics. But this program has moved remarkably quickly. 10 states have now signed legislation to permit the so-called PACE financing. It has made it into the Waxman-Markey climate bill that made it through the House that is not yet through the Senate. Vice President Biden is now the national spokesperson for so-called PACE financing. There's an entire website devoted to it on the White House webpages. And what it has done is essentially to do the following transformation. How many of us would have cell phones if you needed to buy 20 years worth of minutes up front? Right. My daughters would not have cell phones, I can tell you that. What PACE financing does is to permit cities, states, or regions to do this and allow property owners, both residential property and commercial, to invest upfront in clean energy innovations. That can be anything from just doing energy efficiency upgrades and taking advantage of these very large amounts of new federal monies that are available, to doing energy efficiency and then, for example, installing solar on a rooftop or small wind on a farm. All of these things are available funding mechanisms. And in fact, this has been the single biggest transformation in thinking about clean energy projects. To allow individuals, businesses to do this with no upfront financing has become the big change. I just received 2 days ago an announcement that Germany and Florida and Texas now are actually all three looking at reclassifying clean energy vehicles, electric vehicles, as an appliance. So transforming how you think about a car to an appliance because you're going to plug it in, so it should be an appliance. That's the argument they're using in these three areas. To allow financing the clean vehicle part of this equation to be covered under a PACE financing too. Now, none of those are through yet, but there are both US and European versions of doing it. And again, I highlight this particular case in my closing notes because it literally is an innovation that did not come from energy thinking. It came from clever individuals thinking about financing part of the story to make a real quantum leap forward in how we do projects in this area. So again, I want to leave you with that, with things I started with, and that is that those areas that think about these plans in integrated ways, from the research part of the equation up to the workforce training to the market side, dramatically better and more rapid innovations in these areas, and that we are seeing these really dramatic, rapid changes in energy economies. We have seen states and countries rapidly scale up and diversify their energy mix. The final example, in terms of thinking about the cost of energy, is that the first state to pass one of these renewable portfolio standards, not by legislative action, actually, but by popular vote, was Colorado. Colorado's utility cost per person declined by 8%. Not because somehow adding renewables into the mix was better or was globally better on the climate side, but because diversifying away from a very natural gas dependent state to having a large mix of natural gas and wind reduced the price pressures when there were spikes in the gas in the gas prices. So again, utility rates actually fell in one of the most recent states to have adopted one of these pieces of legislation. So again, happy to talk in questions, but again, wanted to illustrate both the big picture and hopefully a few of the details for how these programs had worked. Thank you very much.
Nice job. Any questions for Dr. Kamen? Yes, Representative Townsend. Oh, just a second, wait for the...
Your opinion on this alternate energy sources, are we often putting the cart before the horse? And you made the statement that China is emphasizing development of infrastructure, particularly in a grid thing. And if you look at the United States, one of the biggest potentials in terms of wind energy is basically in the Great Plains. And T. Boone Pickens, I think, was going to invest about $800 million, I believe, in wind turbines, but only to cancel the project because there's no grid system to deliver it to the market.
Right. So this is. I actually think that more of his canceling the project was due to sort of an increasing caution about how quickly we were going to have enough technology available to install. The worry at that time was that the U.S. doesn't produce many of the wind turbines. And there's a few important companies in Iowa, in California, in New York, but we don't have the production capacity that Europe does right now on the turbines themselves. There's two levels of this. One is that in the long term, we are going to need new grid, and in fact, both building out the current grid and the so-called smart grid is one of these big ticket items that has survived it's in the stimulus and it appears in the 2011 budget. So in the long term, grid is going to be built. Building out grid is one of the slowest things that we do. We've not been very successful at doing it rapidly. It typically takes six to eight years to build the big grid lines that we talk about, to bring large amounts of wind power from the Midwest. The other part of it, however, is that smaller wind farms do not require that large build out of the grid. And in fact, right now, the amount of small wind projects, and by small, I mean relatively large, on the 10 to 80 megawatt level, the wind farms of that size are being built around the country and don't require one to wait for that expansion of the grid. So we're really seeing this as an immediate build out in a number of states that have taken it on. But you're right, in the long term, we are going to need new grid projects. We're going to need them, however, even if we don't sort of go green or diversify the economy. We're going to need it because our grid now is quite antiquated. It does not bring the power where we need to go, and it also doesn't do the so-called smart grid story. There's very few locations where the ability of a small wind farm owner or a small biogas producer or a small natural gas producer has the ability to sell new power in from new areas. And so the grid is going to have to be built out and extended no matter what. In fact, that money is effectively in some of the public funding, but private funding as well right now. The question and the battle is, where does it go? Does it go to the areas that diversify into renewables, or does it go into areas that will build out for other technologies? That's where there's this battle going on right now.
Other questions? Okay, go ahead.
I will defer to Representative Kelly.
Thank you. You mentioned the wind turbines being built in Denmark, mm-hmm. and that they converted from a bicycle factory to do this. What's the turnaround time in retrofitting companies and getting a workforce up and going to move ahead with that? Yeah. Because we have a lot of factories in our state that.
Right. So, that. I mean, I'm glad you brought it up. The turnaround time has been, for many cases, very rapid. This is a machine tool industry combined with the computer industry. The turbines themselves, the connection to the grid, are largely computer controlled, and the rest of it is really hardcore machining. So Vestas, the company I mentioned in Denmark, did it relatively rapidly. Clipper, the big Davenport, Iowa company, did it relatively rapidly. The big irony is that most of these new large wind turbine companies did it with U.S. technology. So the technology itself was developed at U.S. corporations and national laboratories to large measure. Companies that started this in the United States, there's a whole range of these, Zond, a whole number of others in the 80s that essentially did this after the Carter run-up, did not have markets available to them. And this technology was then offshored. So Denmark, when I was just there, of course, said thank you very much for supporting our largest, the world's largest wind turbine company. That's actually why the discussions right now, a number of state capitals and in DC are really about doing both. Building these markets so that the companies have a place to go right away. The fact that the majority of U.S. states now have these renewable portfolio standards and there's a production tax credit at the federal level in place has given the rosiest picture for wind that we've ever seen in this country. And so right now, the real question is, which are the companies that are going to retool most rapidly? But we've seen retooling to do wind on the order of 24 to 36 months. So very rapid process is possible in this area. You have time for the one more?
If it's really quick, 30 seconds.
Two-part. One, as I look at your chart on the ramp-up, your second slide, isn't it remarkable that in such a short time, and really with the Recovery Act, that we've completely changed the federal investment in this potential? But two, we feel in Wisconsin, since we're the number one manufacturing state in terms of the percent of our workers who work in manufacturing, right. And we have the amazing University of Wisconsin and all this research, that we're very well poised right. to really excel in this field. If you would just comment on
right.
that.
Right, so I agree with that. That's actually why I was so interested to accept the invitation to come here, because this is a state that has exactly that mixture I'm talking about. This strong technical education system, the university system, and the industrial base is primed for this. And in fact, I've been doing a number of visits to Canada in particular. Ontario has been trying to do this pretty dramatically. Their issue is even less solar radiation, so they've now been looking more at wind, but they have been looking at Michigan and Wisconsin as example states that have the industrial base that they're now talking about sort of mimicking in terms of this transformation. So I actually think that the state is primed to do this.
Thank you. Okay.
Pleasure.
Thank you for coming.